Hey Galveston, this is David Landriot with the 1839, and I'm sitting here with my good friend and councilperson, David Finkley. Say hello, David.
Hello, everyone. Great to be here. Thanks for the invite, David.
Yeah, happy to have you, man. So he indulges me and lets me torture him with all my questions every once in a while. So we're going to try to do this, I think, monthly, right?
Yeah, that'd
okay.
be great.
I got him on recording now. He has to do it. All right. Well, today we wanted to talk about something that sounds really simple, but is very, very complicated. That's why I have one of the smartest people I know here to explain it to me. And that is SB2, right? That's the tax cap. It sounds really simple because people say, oh, you can't raise property tax by more than 3.5%. That's the way most people understand it. But it's more complicated than that, right? It's way more complicated than that.
Yeah, it is. So the 3.5% tax cap is on the revenue that a municipality would pull in. So if you take $100 in, that meant that you can only grow by 3.5%. So your next round of revenue for the next budget would be $103.05. So you're capped at that each year. What is a challenge is that works really well for cities that are booming and growing, urban development, where you have land to go and either annex in that you're doing large-scale residential developments. That is a little more challenging when you're a completely built-out, very mature land block city, as Galveston
right,
is.
Right.
I think
where are we going to put that?
All right. Three descriptors right there in one sentence, right?
Exactly, right. No, and you made a good point. I wanted to explain to people who aren't as smart as you are, there's a carve-out from new construction, right? So with Galveston, we might be lucky to increase our 3.5 by, what, 1% or something like that? I don't know what the numbers are exactly.
It depends upon if you're bringing in new development.
Right.
You get a one-time opportunity when you have significant commercial development come online, or even residential development come online, you can capture that in one full assessment. And then after that, their taxes are going to be capped. What everybody looks to is they're like, oh, hey, Margaritaville is going to be here, or Tierra is going to come online, or the next big condo. The thing is, even after that first year when they have occupancy, you're not going to see that tax revenue for another year because that's when they're going to do the assessment. And you're not going to see that revenue till a full year afterwards.
Wow. Okay.
So there's a huge delay. They can bring in a significant amount of money. One development of that scale could be 2.5% increase in the city's revenue, just that alone.
Wow. That's great. But then those are the unicorns. That's not the rule for sure. That's the exception. And I mean, there's some other issues, right, with this that makes it more difficult for Galveston. Like, this probably works. I know there's even some cities out there that are able to get by with numbers that are under the 3.5 because they have rapid growth or their expenses are a little more capped. But with Galveston, we have tourism, we're on the coast, we're built out. There's all these issues at play that make this tax cap very complicated, to say it nicely. Are there any exceptions for this rule for coastal cities?
There's a bookend. On the high side, it's a 3.5% increase to your revenue from property tax. Okay? Right. That's the cap. On the bottom end, you have to publish a tax rate which assumes that you receive the same amount of property tax revenue from the previous year to the budgeted year that you're working on. And so that's your lower and your upper limit. And then your policymakers, your city council, works hand in hand with your city staff and city management to establish policy to say, what level of services, what quality of life do we want to provide to our residences with all the different things that we provide?
Right.
What level of service do we want to provide? And then set and say, we're willing to do that at this tax rate. And then from there, city management is responsible for developing a budget.
And I mean, here's the thing I didn't understand about this cap is, I know if inflation is like 8 or 9%. How do you keep up with that when you have a maximum increase of 3.5%?
The way that you would keep up with increasing labor and material costs, if those are increasing greater than your tax cap, then what you're hoping for, and hope's not a strategy, but you're hoping that your sales tax increases or your hotel occupancy tax increases,
right,
to help make up that. But material costs are extreme. They have gone up year after year. I'm in the construction business. I know I've seen this directly on my projects. And so since 2020, we've seen year over year increases from 5% to 9 to 10%.
Yeah.
Take labor.
Right.
You know, you always want to take care of the people that are managing and providing services to the city. We've seen increases in labor for our first responders, police and fire, as well as, you know, the council wanted, and rightfully so, to provide a cost of living increase right. to our staff.
And then there's been a lot of talk about increasing salaries anyway to be more competitive because you have to bring people to the island. So that's another difficulty, I would think.
It is. It's a real challenge. Mm. So you're with the 3.5, working within that 3.5% tax cap, it is a challenge to help address those overruns, the increase in material and labor costs that you have to provide in order to provide a certain level of service to your residents.
It sounds like we've already got three strikes against us. We're on the coast. We are capped out and we really can't always predict tourism. We also have to provide all the services for tourists, but hot tax, which is generated by tourism, can't very easily, you said it's very prescriptive. That's a good way to describe it. Can't necessarily very easily be spent just directly spent on things like services. Now it could be maybe, if I understand this right, it could be spent on fire and EMS because those things are tourism related. Is that right?
Well, currently there is some interest in trying to take a hard look to see if that is possible. As I understand, that's not the way that it is done. All of our police and fire is paid for through sales and property tax. Almost all of the sales tax and property tax goes towards funding our first responders. So now you're left with all the other services that you have to provide. And so when it's that big a chunk, and it needs to be, because for every resident, there are something like 168 or so tourists that are visiting the island. And those tourists deserve the level of service that we want. We want to make sure they're safe. We want to make sure that we can get first responders out to them. And that's why we have the number of police officers that have. That's why we have our own fire department. There are very few cities of our size in the state that have their own fire department. Most of them are volunteers. We can't do that here.
Yeah, absolutely. You make a good point there about services. I know you've talked about combining services. Is there any opportunities there to combine services with other institutions on the island? And do you think that's a good idea? Or
the concept of shared services, first off, the city does that to a certain extent in its own city, right? The items that you would consider standard overhead, IT, procurement, finance, are shared services across all of our departments. One of the things I was looking at was, could you extend that and provide that shared service to the other two entities that the city has policy over, which is the Park Board and the Wards Board?
Right.
One is a little easier than the other, but both of them have their own group, right?
Right.
The Park Board has their own procurement, their own finance, their own legal. The Wards Board, the port, has the same thing. Now, we have those services in three different locations. The real challenge is, how do you do that? And that's a longer term discussion, and it has to be very well thought out. It is not just a, okay, let's go do it. It is a long process by which you would take years to accomplish it.
And you would need buy-in from the three groups, I would think, and
cooperation. A lot of cooperation, right. One, the Park Board would be a little more straightforward because that was created by ordinance.
Right.
And so we can make amendments to that as necessary.
The wars by charter, right?
The wars by charter, correct. So that's a little more challenging. But the idea of shared services doesn't stop there. The city recently approved the creation of a marine response unit for coordinating marine responses. When you think about it, who's got a boat? Well, police, fire, beach patrol, the county, the port. And so each of these groups has a response, some sort of procedure in place to respond to incidences on the water.
Right.
And so council created a marine response unit with the intent of helping to provide higher level of coordination for those types of responses.
Great.
That's a great first step and a good example of how you can do that. I think the next step would be is to look at how can you provide a higher level of coordination for items on the island, for incidences on the islands, a coordinated police, fire, sheriff's office type of response.
I would imagine you could have significant savings if you did it that way. And not only that, I'm imagining that not only would it be an efficient saving, but it would be more effective. because you've got all those people moving in the same direction, right?
That's the idea. I've been doing quite a bit of research on it. It's not ready for prime time yet. That's what I'm trying to demonstrate and prove. It takes a lot of time to cull through budgets and to talk about operations and to get input from the various entities. How about another discussion on that later?
All right. We've got two other podcasts we can do at this point. We keep going. But back to SB2, it feels like it's not about ideology. It feels more about whether we can pave our roads or fund police or whether, I mean, I know that there's kind of like a little bit, I guess, of political football being played with some people where, I mean, it sounds really great when you say, I don't want to raise property taxes or I want to cap these property taxes. And I agree, my property taxes are high. I don't want to pay. None of us go, oh, please let me pay more property tax. Mm-hmm. But I also like it when the police show up when I call them or when the fire department is there when I need them or if I can drive down the street without throwing my suspension out on my car. I mean, there's all these things that need to be done. This is a slow bleed on a city like Galveston. We're just, I mean, in a way, we're almost a unique case because we have all the things that make this cap difficult. We have the coast. Let's talk about that a little bit. We're a coastal city. How does this cap affect us if we have a storm?
So storms are very unique events to a city. One of the things the city has done well over the years is establish a reserve. Your reserve is for exactly that. It's so that when sales tax drops off the map, when you have significant devastation and damage to properties, which potentially lowers their value, you have these reserves so that the city continues to operate. And more importantly, in the time of disaster, those reserves are used to go and make that first big push for debris removal, for making sure that your residents are safe, right? Mm-hmm. And you're spending a lot of time, overtime, and energy and dollars to make sure that the city is safe.
And you pay that up front, right? And then FEMA reimburses, if you're lucky, they reimburse 75%.
Correct. And you're waiting for that for two years.
Right. Yeah. In this horrible scenario, we're not wishing a storm on anyone. But if Galveston was to face a serious storm like Ike again, tourism would be down. Property values, people would have damages. People are not spending as much money. Your sales tax goes down. In a situation like that, you cannot do what you would normally do to get the engine going again, right? We're not trying to hurt anybody here. We're just trying to keep the motor running and getting everything back up to speed so we can get tourism back in and people back in their homes. But it seems to me, from my admittedly amateur perspective, that this really hinders your ability to recover from a disaster like that.
By statute, we're required to have 90 days in reserve. At our highest, we had 120, which I think is a really good target. Right now, we're at about 104, 105 or so. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, over time that we should work diligently to increase that. And of course, again, if you're going to try to increase your reserves and still provide the services that you want to your residents, remember the bookends we talked about. You've got the 3.5% cap, and at the bottom end, you've got your no new revenue. It makes it really challenging to do that. You have to determine, you know, what level of services do you want to provide? Right. And I, for example, you know, trash collection.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, do we want to continue to offer heavy trash collection to our residents? Those are the types of policy decisions that council has to wrestle with. The comment about, let's talk a little bit about how you recover. From the short time that I've been here on the island, 10 years or so, I will tell you that from an outsider and also from being on council, the response that I have seen from the city after storms has progressively gotten better year after year. And what that does is that helps minimize the amount of downtime. So that you're open back up for business. So your tourists are coming back to a clean and safe island.
Right.
And I think that that's really important to recognize. And that's part of being resilient. It's not just the physical infrastructure. It is truly your emergency response plan that you're coordinating from streets to drainage to police and fire about how you're taking care of that response.
We have one of the best teams in place to respond to that, and the way they've responded to storms, things like the big freeze, is incredible. But if you don't have the funds to fund that team, that's where it gets tricky. When you see these big drops, traditionally what people would do is raise those property tax rates for a year. And I think they do have some kind of carve out, but it's only 3 years where they allow you some leeway, but it could take much longer to recover from a big storm.
Yeah. Well, like you said, you mentioned it, and I'll use this. There's a urban planning theory, and that's because that's my background. It's called the broken window theory. And it is that if you leave a broken window on a house and it remains there, then over time, you're going to find another broken window. And then on the house next to it, you're going to find another broken window. And that sort of neglect over time propagates throughout the entire community.
Right.
The inverse of that is true on a disaster. In other words, the slower that we are to respond and to take corrective actions to mitigate the effects of the disaster, the longer it's going to take for our sales tax to recover, for hotel occupancy tax to recover, and for our property taxes to recover. If those properties remain in derelict condition a longer period of time post an event, then you're not going to be recovering your property taxes.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Makes sense. All right. Like I said, it sounds simple, but it's not. I hope everybody's following along. David's great at explaining this. When I was trying to understand this, it's like telling a business, okay, your customer base just doubled, but you can't charge more. You can't hire help. You can't keep the lights on unless 51% of your customers vote to say you can, right? Because the only recourse you have here is to go to a bond issue, which very few people want to vote for. Maybe it's happened in a few places where they said, hey, we want to do it for increases for a first responder salary or if they have a particular issue. But just a general bond to say, hey, pay us more. And it's expensive too, right? I mean, you have to then spend the money. We're broke, so we need to spend the money hoping that we'll get more money.
One of the things I learned early on is when you go out to the bond market for projects, you don't go out for bonds for maintenance. You don't go out for bonds for just addressing increases in material costs or labor costs. That's not what you're doing. What you're doing is you're making investment in infrastructure that is going to provide long-term value to your residents. I think that's a balance between setting your tax rate, and actually we're considering going out for a bond. At some point, when you go and issue those bonds, guess what happens? You have a certain level of bonding capacity. In order to pay back those bonds, you have to increase your tax rates. There's a balance between those two. And so I think we are to a point to where a bond program makes sense, particularly as it relates to fire station number two, which is over in the East End behind Arlen's. We've outgrown it. Our equipment is bigger than will fit in the station. A bond program to support the expansion of that so we have newer and appropriate equipment to respond to incidences on the East End, I think is really critical. But there are some other things you ought to look at. For example, I'm hearing that our EMS services from Galveston County, when it first started, it was like $485,000 a year. Then it jumped up to somewhere of $880,000 or $900,000. This year, it's going to be over $1 million. I've only been on council for 3 years. And so I asked myself, okay, so what did I get in level of service for that increase in cost?
Right.
Did I get more EMS people? Did I get more equipment? Did I have a better response time?
Right.
And you start asking those questions and you go, maybe it would be better if we did it ourselves. Now, again, I'm going to throw that out there for people to listen to and to think about, because there's a first cost associated with that. You have to buy all the trucks, right? But if you couple that together with your fire department as well, and there are some firemen that are paramedics as well, long term, your operational costs aren't going to be that $1 million a year. So I say it would require some interlocal agreement changes with Galveston County as well. Yeah. And it would have to have a change management process in place in order to make sure there's no disruption in service.
Right.
Again, that would be a multi-year effort, but it's something that would be interesting to hear from the public and from GFD if this is something that is viable and something they think would help enhance services to our residents.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. So we talked about hurricanes. I was trying to focus on why this is really difficult for Galveston and trying to get my brain wrapped around that. Our sales taxes are already maxed at 8.25, right? And tourism revenue is really volatile. I think we might already be seeing some of the strain if it hadn't been for some of the COVID rescue spending from the federal government that kind of helped out a lot. But it feels to me like this is very difficult for Galveston for reason that if we have a down tourism year, like we have a bad storm on Labor Day or whenever those things go down, our tax dollars go down, but we're still providing we still have to have the police. We still have to have the EMS. There's fixed costs there. It's not like we can go, hey, guys, go home. We don't need you this weekend. So also, I would say, isn't it true that Galveston has a lot of tax-exempt land? That's another thing. And it's not necessarily that that's bad, but it is one of the situations, like you said, we're built out. There's a lot of tax-exempt land. We have storms. It's kind of like the triple threat for Galveston. Do you think there should be some kind of exemption or carve-out for coastal cities or people that are in unique situations?
I think, one, you could look at coastal cities. And the other thing that would be interesting to do is, like, first off, an idea of a coalition of coastal cities for the purposes of affecting change at the state level or the federal level. But the other thing that would be interesting is to take a look at other cities whose revenue is largely driven by tourism. You have a small population, but a large influx of tourism that provides benefit to the residents in terms of helping keep property taxes as low as possible. But the truth is that they're also here utilizing the infrastructure that we have put in place and services for first responders. It would be interesting to see if you could do a coalition of those. The challenge is that I think you'd have to reach outside of Texas, and it's more of a federal appeal rather than a state appeal.
Right. Well, let's assume that nothing's going to change in the legislature. That's probably a fairly safe bet, right? It usually is. It's hard to get legislature change, but what are the smart solutions that we can try to do to edge around this, at least slow the bleed while they try to work on the legislation to make them understand that we're being squeezed in a way that others aren't? One thing that people bring up a lot, and I know that you know a lot about this, is hot tax and that being used for some of our EMS and police services, since those are being used. Brian Maxwell told me recently that 40% of the calls they get are tourist related. They're not resident related. So that's a pretty big percentage of our expense.
I think we'll go back to the idea that you mentioned about a large amount of our property is tax exempt because it's either owned by the city or a UTMB or foundations, Moody Gardens, or is managed for the city. For example, the port.
Right.
There are different responses for each one of those different conditions, right? Because we have a world-class healthcare system here with UTMB that you absolutely want to keep feeding,
100%.
Right? And so the revenue that's generated off of that, I mean, it's really the people working there spending their hard-earned money on the island.
Right.
You want to absolutely fuel that. The city land, I mean, there's not much you can do about that because it is a city land. The port of it as its own sort of enterprise, right? Whatever is developed on the port, the revenue generated there goes back to help improve the port. They're getting ready to do, I mean, they've already outstripped their previous master plan, which was not that old, and they're redoing one right now and looking to make a significant amount of infrastructure investment directly adjacent off of Harborside to help encourage both residents and tourists to spend more time on port property.
Right.
And
right.
That's huge. They've been able to accelerate that.
Mm-hmm.
And the city has over time taken opportunities to help bring back some of the revenue generated to the city to provide services to our residents. And we did that through long-term parking fee and a boarding fee for cruise passengers. And while they're fairly minimal on the individual basis, in aggregate, they're bringing in, I think, over $2 million a year. And that's significant. If that is the way we want to look at cost share with the port, that's fine. I think that we still need to make sure that we do a comparative analysis to other port cities to see if there are some other best practices in terms of making sure that we're not overextending ourselves on the investment in the port. And that's generating a significant amount of tourism, but that also puts a burden on our city infrastructure as well.
All right, I want to come back to that in a minute because that's an important point. But what do you think about using hot tax for police and fire? Do you think that's a viable solution? Some of my research seemed to indicate others had done it, but I don't know if we're in the same exact because they're not by charter. They were created by the city, right? So I don't know if different rules apply because of that or whether state rules supersede that.
When we've continually asked that question, the answer we get back is that it's governed by the state. Your point, where Mr. Maxwell said that over 40% of the calls for police and fire are directed for tourism. Mm-hmm. It ought to be one of the key metrics that you use to make the case that you ought to be able to use hotel occupancy tax to help right. fund your first responders. Right. I will continue to ask that question and see if there's a way to come around it from another angle, but that is one of the prime areas that could provide relief for the cost of those very important services.
And just for context, these are not small costs. I'm just guessing at this, from what I remember, but police, those type of services, first responders, around 50% of the budget? 60% of the budget.
Yeah.
So, wow. So just doing little quick math, that's a significant savings. You'd be looking at, it's over 20% would make it.
It could make a big difference. I think it's important to continue to press upon that and to see at either a local or a state level if there's a way that we could create a better way to share those costs associated with those services with our tourists.
Just to prove to the listeners I can actually do basic math, I think that's 24%. Yep, I kind of stumbled on it. So 24% is almost a quarter of the budget that you could potentially fund through hot tax. That's a big deal if it's doable. I know that's probably a podcast in itself. I just wanted to get your opinion on that because it's something that I honestly don't understand, and I know a lot of people don't understand it, and I know that you do. So coming back to the port and infrastructure and investments and growth out there, you cannot argue that the port is not an economic powerhouse. They are fueling the city, bringing tourism in. All of us would like those tourists to stay longer. We wish they were bringing them here to stay for 10 days, right? But, we're getting more and more of them. I know that we work for Sunflower Bakery and Cafe through Falcontail. We see a lot of the cruise passengers come in all the time. So we know they're coming in. I don't know how long they're staying, but that's really great for the island. But then there's this new development recently with the Davy Shipbuilding and Gulf Copper. We talked about this a little bit ahead of time. We've got a cheat sheet going together here, but we talked about, some of the issues and things like that, right, that we could face with this deal. I feel like it's a really great deal. They're looking at $1 billion. I know that's not all of investment. That's not all going to be in Galveston, but a lot of that would be on port property, as you informed me earlier. I think there's some big opportunities there. If you landed that plane right, it would be a huge success for the community if you could get those workers to come in, spend their money, and live there, especially, and boost the schools, bring kids in. These are working people who have families. They bring in kids. It sounds almost too good to be true. So tell me why it might be a little bit too good to be true, and how can we make it work?
The first thing first is, and this is an editorial, it's not everybody on council, but I can't believe that there would be somebody that would be opposed to this. The city should absolutely be 100% behind Davy and Gulf Copper, making sure that they are successful in putting together a extremely competitive proposal for those federal shipbuilding contracts that they're right. looking for. I mean, that's the reason why Davy right. wanted to make the purchase.
Yeah. Davy bought out Gulf Copper to seek a federal contract. They have $5 billion set aside for icebreaking, and that's what Davy does. They build these icebreakers. They're critical to our national security, especially now with global warming and the Arctic is becoming a hotly contested area. We don't have many icebreakers. We have, I don't know, five or something. I mean, we don't have any at all. And so this is huge, not only for the nation, but for Texas, because we've been trying to attract this type of shipbuilding. But for Galveston, it is an incredible opportunity to bring in up to 4,000 new workers.
The city should absolutely be on board to support that proposal however we can, mm-hmm. ranging from a simple letter that goes into their proposal that says, hey, the city's right here. We're helping provide additional either infrastructure or making sure it's coordinated, all the way to looking at incentives that could be provided as a part of that additional investment. I know that they are actively looking at the Texas Enterprise Fund at the state level, but great. There are also some things at the local level that you can look at in terms of tax abatements, 380 agreements, or what they're commonly referred to.
Right.
And in fact, I've been meeting with our economic development coordinator, Michelle Hay, over the past 6 to 9 months. We've been taking a hard look at the existing 380 agreements and been slowly making some recommendations for consideration to council on maybe changing those and loosening the strings a little bit. The previous 380 agreements were very restrictive in terms of the types of development or redevelopment that we were looking to encourage. Some of them were very successful, but we really need to broaden this out and look more across a variety of types of industries to encourage that type of development. So you're going to see actually at the next council meeting, if I'm not mistaken, Michelle is going to be providing an update on that. And it would be good to get those. And that's to get those updated, because I think that the development community would could respond favorably if we loosened the restrictions on what types of development and what level of investment we were looking for. There is a whole host of other tools available to a municipality for encouraging additional development. In my graduate degree program in civil engineering, we studied that quite a bit. When I graduated, I worked for a group called Uptown Houston, which is in the Galleria area.
We talked about that.
Yeah, we created one of the most successful tax increment reinvestment zones, TERS 17, that has really helped spur additional development over the past 20 years into the Galleria area.
So explain for regular listeners and a little bit for me, what exactly is it?
A tax increment reinvestment zone? It is a geographical boundary created by the vote of typically commercial property owners. They can be done for other purposes, but most commonly they're in commercial economic development areas. What it does is it says that any additional growth in value, so say you have $100 worth of value in a geographic area,
right?
If that value increases, you know, by that ad valorem value increases, then the tax on that additional value goes back into the reinvestment zone. And it can be broken up a whole host of different ways. And not only that, but some groups could participate and some could might not. Mm-hmm. For example, you might get the city to participate, but the school district might not participate because obviously you don't want to necessarily cap those dollars to that geographic area. That needs to go to the broader ISD.
Yeah.
So what that does is that provides a guaranteed revenue stream to a geographic area that then you can do small bonds or take out loans to do infrastructure projects based upon your future anticipated revenue.
What I'm hearing is loophole.
It's not a loophole. Some critics of tax increment reinvestment zones say you're just taking that increment and putting it back into that geographic area rather than letting that value lift up the entire community as a whole. We're doing that with the port.
I got you.
What's happening at the port is no different. The value of those improvements that happens on city property that's managed by the port go back to fund improvements on the port property.
Okay. Going back to Davies a little bit, one great thing about this project is it diversifies. We already have a very strong healthcare. You mentioned UTMB. They're amazing. We've got good tourism. We've got restaurants. And people have talked about we need more jobs. So this does seem like the answer, bringing in 4,000 new workers to our community, if we can get them to live here. How do we make sure that those people don't just cross over into Texas City? If they cross the causeway, then all we've done is just created a lot of traffic to and fro and increased our infrastructure costs, right? So it feels to me like some of the success of this project, and I know they would eat lunch there and there's still value, but it's some of the success of the project might depend on getting people to live there. But I also talked to Tom Schwenk, who recently passed, as everybody knows. He did an interview. He talked about the glut of real estate now because there's all these people who've built short-term rentals. And we talked about opportunities, and I wish I would have thought to ask him about the Davies situation and the people coming in. There are all these properties, and they're great investment properties for people. That's what Tom told me, for people who want to live there long-term. You're not going to come in and flip them. You're not going to come in and make them a short-term rental. But if you're looking for a place to live long-term, and especially if this project went well, and people moved in, the value of property is going to go up. Everybody's property values would go up and tax revenue would go up because the sales tax and everything and these new workers. So what could we do? We do have a real estate market that's kind of primed for it, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that helps a lot. But is there anything else that you can do to kind of encourage these people to live where they work, other than just it's already convenient?
Right. So you're sort of hanging out your shingle saying, hey, look, it's really convenient. It's just right across the Pelican Island Bridge to get to work.
Right.
I think that the timing of this Davy deal in terms of their hiring plan looks right. They've hit the real estate market at the right time.
Yeah.
To the point that Tom mentioned, we do have an excess of available properties. A large portion of those properties are ones that have already been refurbished that were being used for short-term rentals. But when the interest rates went through the roof, those individuals aren't able to service their debt or to be profitable. The unfortunate thing is not just those individuals that are facing that economic downturn, but that also has an impact on property values in the community. We have seen a decrease in the dollar per square foot sales price over the past year as a result of this. And that's not necessarily great for the island, but it also provides a real opportunity for those individuals that are wanting to live on the island. If you're fortunate enough to live on the island, maybe you're fortunate enough.
Yeah, that's true. That's what Tom always said. Those of us who were lucky enough to know Tom were lucky enough. You know, he's a great guy.
I don't know if I fully answered your question, but outside of doing the things that the council is doing in terms of trying to keep your overall property tax low, right? We can't control the assessed value of these individual properties. That's done by Galveston County Appraisal District.
Right.
And they're responding to market conditions. Mm-hmm. So what it gets back to is that what type of city do we want to be?
Right.
Do we want to be a city that has a thriving urban core of residents here? Mm-hmm. Or do you just want to end up looking like Destin? I mean, I know which one I'd prefer.
Right.
Those are two different visions of what you could have this city look like. And the policies that you put in place and even the tax rates that you put in place are going to drive that type of market.
Well, that's a good time to talk about something else that I wanted to bring up. So I know across the state there have been, and maybe locally here too, there are people who've proposed zero tax increase, right? And tell me what that might look like for Galveston in your mind.
Starting with that as your goal is not a strategy, because what that doesn't do is it doesn't even start with what type of city do you want to be? What do you want to look like? The thing you should be saying is what level of services do you want to provide to your residents?
Right.
Start with that. Can't imagine any business, you know, Tillman Fertitta over at Landry's first starts with, I want to offer the cheapest food possible. He's going to start with something that says, I want to offer the best experience possible at the lowest competitive price.
My customers really want excellent trash pickup. They want bulk trash pickup. They want first responders to show up. Everyone wants the firefighters to show up when your house is on fire.
They see less flooding in their streets.
Yeah. And I mean, I get that, like, to use your analogy, everybody wants to go to the restaurant and order the lobster and pay a dollar for it. But what kind of lobster are you getting for a dollar, right? That's the danger. But I think it goes deeper than that. And maybe I'm wrong about this, but because I defer to your expertise, you can't even take advantage of growth opportunities when you say, we're going to stay at zero. If you have a chance to grow, I can understand when people are pinched saying, oh, I don't want to pay more. But why would we not want to take the opportunity to grow the city when we have the chance to do it if we had a big boom? Because that's very common, as I understand it, to just go up temporarily on those in order to grow the city. And you bring in more tax dollars and it's more healthy. And then those things go down. It's like if you get a chance to buy $100 for $10, you won't say, well, I'm not going to spend $10. You want to spend that $10 and then 2 years later you get $100. That's a good investment. So, I mean, to me, and maybe I'm oversimplifying it,
I think that what the state legislature did is give policymakers your boundaries, your lower end and your upper end, and you have to play within that. It becomes even more complex when you have the variables of tourism that generates a significant amount of hotel occupancy tax that goes back and is invested in the city. Mm. Also, from what I understand from management, the rough split on sales tax between residents and tourists hovers around 50%, which is interesting. What that means is your residents that are living here are spending their dollars on the island, which is what you would expect.
Well, since we've talked about all the problems, let's talk about creative alternatives. It's very difficult. I think long-term lobbying would be an interesting solution to try to get people to see that we're in a unique situation. Not only are we on the coast, but we're tourism driven, and that's already two strikes against us. What kind of special purpose districts, impact fees for high-load developers, things like that? What do you think? What's the lowest hanging fruit for Galveston?
I like the step that we took with the creation of a Marine Response Unit. I think that the principle behind that in terms of increasing coordination and improving your responses to your residents and to tourists is a very good objective.
Mm-hmm.
So if you translate that into other areas as well, the idea of shared services between the city and the park board and then potentially the wars board, I think that's a really good one that deserves a lot of attention to try to see, because I think long term you could generate some nice efficiencies there. And that doesn't even have anything to do with setting your tax rate. I think the other low-hanging fruit is getting the 380 agreement language updated and becoming less restrictive. If we can get an answer that says we can use hotel occupancy tax for public safety, that would be huge. Mm-hmm. I think just those three things alone could make a good difference.
Yeah, smart.
Yeah, I think that the other thing, and we talked about the what do we want to be as a city, and you know, we've started a comprehensive plan, and it's going to take a while to develop. There's going to be public meetings where the residents can come in and give us their thoughts about what do they want to see? What's really important?
Mm-hmm.
Is it public safety? Is it drainage? Tell me more about those so that we can create a comprehensive plan for the next 10 years that guides our policymaking.
Mm-hmm.
That is so important because where we were 13 years ago when the 2011 plan was done and where we are today, we look completely different. And so we need to make sure that we spend the time to talk to our residents and to find out from the community about what do we want to be in the next 10 years and 20 years.
Yeah. And also a perfect segue to the next question I wanted to ask, which is, let's say that we adopted a zero increase tax rate. It's not going to bankrupt us in a year or two, but it's a slow bleed, right? So if we projected out, let's say 10 years, what does that look like for residents? You know, would it be delayed storm drainage? Would it be underfunded emergency services? Probably likely, because that's one of our bigger expenses. No housing funding. I mean, there are a lot of services. Trash, obviously, bulk pickup would be gone. It's a pretty bleak picture in my mind.
It is. I think you would have to make the policy. Well, if you extrapolate a no new revenue over time, it becomes more draconian for the reasons that we mentioned, that you're not able to respond to, assume that you want to keep the same level of service, you're not even able to respond to escalation costs, material costs, labor costs, replacing equipment. You can't even, and you're assuming that you're keeping the same level of service. Now, if you decide to make that change and say, I'm going to decrease the level of services so that I can keep that no new revenue and keep setting that tax rate.
Right.
And I think one of the reasons why the no new revenue is so strenuous on planning is that the growth in our ad valorem value is less than or around 1%.
Right. Okay.
If you're only growing at 1% and you're trying to set, you know, no new revenue rate, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, I agree. One thing we haven't touched on is the fact that you couldn't even keep up with inflation on construction costs. And we have an old infrastructure. The town is very old. That could be the third strike against us. We've got to invest in these things, but no new revenue, you couldn't even keep up with the services, much less think about adding new infrastructure projects. You could do bonds, but those are difficult and you'd already be struggling in other areas anyway.
The one good thing that Galveston did years ago is city council passed a resolution that said 8% of your revenue has to go into capital improvement projects. Mm-hmm. If we didn't have that, that capital improvement fund would be the first thing that people go grab. Right. It's easy to turn off a project and redirect those funds for operation. But projects take a long time to plan and to implement. It's important to recognize that the city of Galveston realizes that infrastructure improvements are critical to the success and vibrancy of the community. And so having that 8% go directly towards capital improvement projects is critical. So even if we haven't touched on the bonds, even if you set at the same no new revenue rate, you still have the same dollar value to spend on capital improvements. That just means that's all you're going to spend.
Right. And with the inflation costs on projects and things like that, still, I feels like it's difficult to really do everything that we need to do. But let's end on a rosier note. Let's say that all three of these smart ideas that you talked about come to fruition. If we're looking at that picture 10 years from now, we keep the 3.5 and use that to invest and grow and really build a city that provides those services that the citizens want, right? Because again, they don't want the $1 lobster. They want the real lobster. If we're able to do that, paint me a picture of that. What does that look like?
I think the city of Galveston becomes even more beautiful than it is. I think you would continue to see the reinvestment in urban housing that you've seen over the past 10 years. I think you would continue to see a very vibrant, clean beach where tourists come down and enjoy. That is the reason that people come to Galveston.
They do.
It is nature. It is to be there in the water or at least see the water, have that calming presence. And I think that you end up with a very healthy island in terms of services and amenities that provide for your residents and that are appealing to tourists as well. Those things that I mentioned as well is the investment that Davey's making with Gulf Copper, loosening the strings on 380 agreements. I mean, it would be really good to see that. I'd love to say after we make that, we hang out the new shingle and the developers go, hey, look, maybe it's more possible for us to invest down here. I think we're doing well as a city in terms of making sure that we have the reserves that we have on hand, that we are providing the services that that residents are looking for. Do we have pains here and there? Absolutely. We have a drainage improvement master plan that we're moving forward with, but those pump stations are expensive and take time. But those are going to be important for us to maintain our resiliency. So I think that if you're able to make those small scale improvements and keep your eye on the long-term success of the island, your policy decisions are going to drive towards that.
I'm kind of imagining it like 10 years from now. If we get the shipbuilding deal, we keep those people on the island, we increase the number of kids going to the schools, we diversify away from tourism, which is what everyone has said we should do. We've overbought into the tourism side of it. Unless we build around that, we can't support it. But if you added those new agreements, you bring in different industries, developers are coming in, you can tax that at a higher rate. I mean, if you're able to spend that 3.5% when you have a growth opportunity and quickly recover when you're down, you know, I feel like the island is increment. It's 3.5 doesn't sound like that much, right? It just really doesn't. It's like, oh, 3.5%. It's almost nothing, right? It's everything when it comes to the growth and recovery of the island. You know, it's what we need. If zero is all your expenses and you can't quite pay the rent, and then 3.5 gets you over the line, that's a pretty big jump, right? I know it's more complicated than that, but even things like getting Galveston College, we talked about this before, to do training programs for welders, for Davies and things like that. We could build the community out. We could weave these things together in a way where it's like, I imagine this Galveston that is as good as it's improved in the last 13 years, I imagine, you know, the next 10 could be three times as
good.
Could
be much greater. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I'm glad we share that vision for Galveston. Luckily, all I have to do is a podcast. You have to go make it happen.
It's truly been an honor to serve the residents in this role.
Yeah. I'd probably get in trouble if I didn't ask. Your term's coming up here pretty soon. You sure you're not going to run again?
I'm not running again. May of 2026 will be my last council meeting, and I'll hand the reins over to whoever the citizens elect.
We should talk about that more. I really appreciate it. Let's see if I had something here I wanted to use for a wrap up. Oh, yeah, this is a good way to close this out. The smartest cities are going to see that wall coming at them. We could use a tanker as a metaphor for obvious reasons. We see an obstacle in the water ahead of us, and it's a big one. We can't wait 5 years to start to turn the tanker. We have an opportunity now to make a small turn towards this 3.5, increase our revenue growth, make ourselves more resilient, and avoid that wall. And that's what I hope that Galveston will do. What do you think are the chances that...
I'm hoping that... Well, I will tell you that you're going to hear a lot of noise. You're going to hear a lot of, oh, well, maybe we could just take money from this fund and shift it over to this fund. I don't agree with the way shared services is splitting expenses between departments. That's not our job as policymakers. Our job is to identify what level of services we want to provide to our residents and stay laser focused on that. Let our city management do their job and provide the services and responses that our residents and tourists look for.
Right.
I am hoping that logical heads will come to the table to see that you do have to take a long-term approach with this. It is not just setting a budget for a year. What you're doing is year after year, you are moving the baseline by which you're going to be viewed the following year related to property tax.
Because each year those increases are exponential. You know, you're increasing the base every time. So it's not just another 3.5. It's like compounding interest, essentially. I don't want to quit without saying that I think the management you have in Galveston right now, I have a lot of faith in them, and I know a lot of people do. This is a good council, and I know you guys will make smart decisions. We've just got to keep doing that year after year until we get to that vision we share, and I think we will.
I hope so, too.
I'm an optimist. So,
yeah, so am I.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming today, David. We didn't mention a Rush song, so we'll have to work two into our next podcast.
I think the one I would close with is the quote by Neil Peart, changes aren't permanent, but change is.
Yeah, that's a great one. It's so relevant to what we're talking about because people want to hold on to what we're already doing, but that's not change. Everything is going to change. We're going to have to adapt to the future.
I like it because the changes that you make aren't necessarily permanent, but the idea of change and evolution is always going to be
exactly.
There.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I appreciate you coming today. Thanks a lot. And hopefully we can do this again next month and we'll find another topic or expand on this one.
My pleasure.
Good seeing you.